as we hear the gospel lesson. The gospel reading this morning is from the Gospel of Mark, the 15th chapter, verses 25 through 37. I'll be reading from the New Revised Standard Version. Hear now the words of God. It was 9 o'clock in the morning when they crucified him. The inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two bandits, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by derided him, shaking their heads and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." In the same way, the chief priests, along with the scribes, were also mocking him among themselves and saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. Let the Messiah, the King of Israel, come down from the cross now so that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also taunted him. When it was noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m. At 3 o'clock, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of the bystanders heard it, they said, "Listen, he's calling for Elijah." And someone ran, filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a stick, and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let's see whether Elijah will come and take him down." And then Jesus gave a loud cry and breathed his last. This is the word of God for God's people. Praise be to God.
You may be seated. The choir did a magnificent job this morning. Thank you, Lynn, and thank you, Barbara, and for all who made that happen. What a beautiful, beautiful way to begin a Palm Sunday service. And, of course, next week we will be privileged to be a part of the rest of the cantata on Easter Sunday. This is a journey that begins in happiness and ends in death. There isn't any other way to put it. If you notice, it's called Palm Passion Sunday. And that means we're a part of both experiences. But then again, isn't that what life is all about? Life and death experiences, we experience all of our lives and go through much together. So we journey into Jerusalem with Jesus, and we also journey with Adam Hamilton as he takes us to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And there we will experience some interesting scenes, if you have not been there before, of where the crucifixion took place and where perhaps Jesus was buried. Let's travel now with Adam Hamilton.
I'd like to take you to the place where Christians from the earliest centuries of the faith have journeyed to remember the crucifixion. I'm standing in front of Christianity's holiest shrine. This is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and it marks the place where Jesus was crucified, dead, and buried. It's built on top of a rock formation that rises up some height. That rock formation was called Calvary because it looked like a skull, Calvaria, a skull, or Golgotha. And in ancient times, it was a rock quarry just outside the city walls of Jerusalem where the Romans took persons to crucify them on this hill. The main road went just past it, so they were humiliated in front of the populace, but outside the city walls. The first church was built on this location around 330 AD. It was later destroyed, rebuilt. And the church you see behind me was actually built in the Crusader period in 1103. It also has been destroyed and rebuilt multiple times. The last time in the 19th century, it was destroyed by fire and then rebuilt. There are multiple different Christian groups that claim this as their own. And as I said, this is the holiest shrine for Christians. To the right is as you can see, the stairs ascending takes you to Calvary and the top of the rock formation where Christ was crucified.
No, you're all right. I'm sorry.
Where Christ was said to have been buried, the tomb where he was buried and then raised from the dead.
Thank you. Let's pray together. Well, Lord, the journey begins, and your holy word comes to life as we gather in your name. May we be sensitive to the presence of Christ among us. May we be willing to journey with him during these last days, and may we be open to his directions and guidance in our life as we study your holy word this day. And may the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. In 1968, just outside of Jerusalem, an ossuary or a bone box was found. It belonged to a man who was about 27 years of age and identified by the name of Yohanan. The human remains inside the box were believed to come from the first century and included a heel bone with a nail protruding through it and wrist bones bearing evidence of damage from a rope that apparently had cut through the skin. This was the first set of bones ever found with a clear evidence of crucifixion. The first ever. When they looked at the bones, it was quite apparent that the legs of Yohanan had been broken. And the Romans did that to expedite death. Now, it perhaps caused a blood clot or increased stress on the system. It might have made it harder to breathe, but it was done to expedite death, to bring it quicker. Looking more closely at the arrangement of the bones, scholars have said that the victim would have had his feet pressed against the outside of the vertical beam of the cross. And the feet on the outside of the beam were then twisted, and the nails went through the heel on either side and nailed into the beam. A little different than perhaps we have thought before, and that may be the way Jesus was nailed to the cross. And then they talk about the wrist being bound. That was one way to do it. The other way was the way Jesus was probably crucified. And yes, nails through the wrist, through the upper hand, to hold him onto the cross, to make sure the body was secure in every way. You see, crucifixion was a form of Roman terrorism. We're big into terrorism these days. The Romans knew about it long before we practiced it. Roman terrorism. And although they did not invent crucifixion, they practiced it for over 800 years quite successfully, because it struck fear into the victims and it struck fear into the populace. And that's what they intended to do. That's why it was an act of terrorism. In order to keep the peace of Rome, the Pax Romana crucifixion, of course, was made as public as possible. You want everybody to see it, as many as possible. After all, it was a calculated social deterrent, along with other such supreme penalties, such as being burned alive or thrown into a cage or form where beasts ate the body. You see, terrorism. Maximum punishment. Not only to the victim, but to everybody else who would witness it. Crucifixions often took place in the thoroughfare where people would see them. You'd want to have a maximum audience in every way, shape, or form for the event. The vertical beam of the cross was always left in place, because every time you would go by it, the first thing that would come to your mind is, there will be another crucifixion in the not-too-distant future. And the one thing that I hope it was will not be mine. It was a constant threat, a constant scare. Crosses were close enough to the ground. No, not 8 or 9 or 10 or 12 feet high. Close enough to the ground, perhaps 3 feet, where dogs and other animals and carrion birds could attack the body after the one crucified was dead. And the hope was, in the midst of it all, that there would be nothing left to bury after the crucifixion occurred. In Rome, after crucifixion, if there was still a body, the body was given over to the family for burial. This isn't pleasant at all. It is crucifixion, as crucifixion was. The goal of crucifixion is quite apparent. Maximum agony, maximum pain, maximum humiliation for the longest possible time, for the victim and the victim's family and friends and for the community to experience it, to take it in, and to understand that there, by the grace of God, go you. For over 800 years, a successful act of terrorism for the Romans. When we as Christians look at Jesus upon the cross, Will Willimon said some beautiful words. He said, "We are privileged to see as much of God as we as have ever hoped to see." You want to see God? Then take a look at the cross. You want to see what God is willing to bear for us? Then take a look at the cross. You have a clearer vision of who God is when you know who Jesus Christ is. I love another quote that Will Willimon gave us. He quotes Karl Barth. And all of us at some time or another in seminary studies have heard about Karl Barth, the great theologian. But maybe one of his greater statements was this. And I took it in quite seriously today. A preacher has nothing better to do. Ah, yes. Nothing better to do than to stand like John the Baptist and with a bony hand point people toward the cross. A preacher has nothing better to do than this. I thought, wow, that's really what it's all about. That's really where we begin and where we end. It's what it's all about. Mark writes in his gospel, very simple words and a very short statement about the crucifixion. It was 9 o'clock in the morning when they crucified him. That's all. Why? Because people knew about it already. It had already spread orally as well as in written form. It was 9 o'clock in the morning when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." Now imagine the scene before us, the cross before us. The soldiers down probably at this level, and the cross just above them. And they're on the ground. They're down on all fours. They've been through this time and time again. You've seen one crucifixion, you've seen them all. And that was their job, by the way. Their eyes are focused on the ground, not up here on the cross. The criminal above them, 3 feet away, is totally forgotten. And what are they doing? They're gambling for some used clothing. Used clothing. A tunic. A cloak. Some sandals. The things are there for the taking. And they're going to gamble it. And each soldier throws his luck on the hard earth, hoping to go away with just a small increase in his wardrobe that he would not otherwise have had. At the expense of the carpenter, the insurrectionist who is dying on that cross. Jesus' eyes, I imagine at this time, are definitely pointed downward. Downward. He sees you there around the cross. He sees those who walk by. in the midst of his pain, he catches all the experience of people. Some who support him, many who don't care, and others who deride him. Hey, what's the matter with you? You saved others? Save yourself, will you? Come on, save yourself. You think you're smart, do you? All the things you've talked about and practiced, you saved all these others. Go ahead now, save yourself. King of the Jews, King of the Jews, I'll believe it. If you're the king, you'll come down from the cross. Yeah, let's show the world what kind of a king you really are. I know as sure as I'm standing here, I just feel it in my soul, that there was a poignant moment when Jesus glanced down in the midst of his pain and he caught a glimpse of his mother and John, his friend. You can picture that before you, can't you? Just a looks down and just gets a glimpse of Mary, who has not left his side. I don't think he has to say it loudly. She's right there. Here is your son. I sometimes think we overlook that touching moment. Here's your son, Mama. And she, through her tears, felt his pain and saw his agony. And he felt her presence and saw her love. You know what it's like to be a mother. You know what went between them in that few moments that words cannot describe. Here's your son, Mom. As she looked into her eyes. And then in a beautiful act of love, Jesus looks over to John, his trusted friend. And he says to him, here's your mother. It's as if to say, take good care of her. You're a wonderful friend. Watch over her. Be with her. She needs all the support she can have. All the support she can possibly get. Oh. It is a beautiful scene. And the longer Jesus hung on the cross, the more exhausted he became. The more difficult it was to exhale. Sometimes the only way he could breathe was to try in the midst of crucifixion some way and to pull yourself up so you could exhale and inhale. And the pain was suffering as the one being crucified tried to do a simple act of breathing. Breathing became more and more shallow, and crucifixion often a very slow and agonizing death by asphyxiation. And other researchers say death may have come by a congestive heart failure, or it may have been through shock or dehydration or loss of blood. Jesus hung on the cross, bloodied and naked for 6 hours as all walked by. We understand Jesus' humanity and Jesus' suffering, especially when he cries out in the midst of his own despair. And I don't know whether this was a loud cry or a cry within his own heart. My God. And I know what he's really saying. Abba. Oh, Daddy. Father. Why in the midst of all of this suffering and all of this pain have you abandoned me and let me alone? Why? Jesus would have remembered these words well from Psalm 22. Take a look at them. They're the first words. My God, why have you forsaken me? But you see, if Jesus knew this psalm, he also knew the rest of it. He also knew the rest of it. But for right now at that moment, he just felt absolutely alone. Have you ever felt alone in your life? I mean, really alone? I think you have. I felt alone when I went to basic training at 18 years of age, 3 days after Christmas. Yeah, I got there and they did nothing but yell at me. I thought I was home. Horrifying. For a long time, I felt so alone. I remember also when I went away from the family for a year by myself over in Turkey with 600 other guys and one woman. And for the first month, I couldn't get the knot out of my stomach because I felt so alone. When my mother died, I felt alone. Couldn't bring her back. Nothing I could do. When you've lost a loved one, when your child leaves home, you feel alone. When I lose a pet, I feel alone. Because that pet has been a part of my life. We know what Jesus went through. And there are times we too say, my God, why have you abandoned me? I don't know where to turn. But in the midst of the suffering, he would turn to words of triumph and hope within this Psalm 22, which ends with great words of assurance and hope and victory. Verse 24, for example, and the Message translation is blunt, that's why I use it. And it says this way, he's never let you down, never looked the other way when you were being kicked around. He never wandered off to do his own thing. He's been right there with you, listening. He's been right there at 9 o'clock on a Friday morning. God was right there, listening. In his book, A Glimpse of Jesus, Brennan Manning says this. He said, the crucified Christ is not an abstraction of the ultimate response to how far love will go. Is not an abstraction, but the ultimate response to how far love will go. What measure of rejection it will endure, how much infidelity and self-centeredness and betrayal it will withstand. That is love. That is love in its greatest definition. You see, the cross is the lens through which we see God. You cannot get to Easter Sunday without Good Friday. You cannot do it. It's the lens through which we begin to see God and understand how much God has given of God's self to us. It is the lens through which we grasp the victory of Easter. It is the lens through which we are restored to a new and right relationship with God and with each other. My Lord, have mercy. Do we need that today? It not only restores our relationship to God, but with each other. And those of you who aren't talking to family members or friends or your backdoor neighbor or someone in the church because you're too self-centered and egotistical, get off your counter and see what the cross is all about. It turns your life around and it turns your relationships around, and it's the only thing that will do it. And the amazing thing, Paul says, is that it was done while we were yet sinners. Oh, my Lord, have mercy. You know, you would expect all this to come after everything is cleared up. You know, and that somebody would have a good relationship with me after everything was cleared up. And God says, no, you're a rotten person. And in the midst of all of that, Jesus died for me. You didn't have to do anything. You didn't have to be deserving of anything at all. And God gave his very best. So, you see, I have no other message today. And nothing better to do. Nothing better to do than stand like John the Baptist, however John the Baptist stood. And with a bony hand, point you to the cross. And then Jesus gave a loud cry and breathed his last.